Honestly, this could have been worse, and could very well get worse, and could very well be much worse, through just information we simply don't have from what's happening in Armenian villages in Nagorno-Karabakh. But I do think that the Turks are probably exerting some influence to try to keep it from getting worse.
To understand geopolitics, you must have the freedom to be honest.
The More Freedom Foundation podcast.
So, Rob, this week we have a very sad set of events unfolding.
Yeah, there's not much space for a cute segue this week. We'll be talking about Nagorno-Karabakh and what is unfolding there.
Our Artsakh.
Artsakh is not a name that I prefer to use, but it's certainly one that's thrown around. I think that it's important to emphasize at the beginning that I am traditionally someone who's very much a Turkey advocate, and the way that I've covered this conflict, I've been quite much more sympathetic to Azerbaijan than most media sources. And that's not going to change today. But I think it's important to emphasize that what's happening now is pretty horrifying, and its history is happening.
And also, we're not fully aware of what exactly is happening.
Certainly. The true extent of atrocities that may or may not be being committed is unknown at this point. It's imaginable that Azerbaijan is acting with, if they were smart, they'd be acting with a great deal of restraint. Unfortunately, I don't think what we've seen from Azerbaijan so far makes it seem that that's likely. The sad fact is they are likely to get what they want without brutality. It seems, as of this recording, it seems that at least half, perhaps more than half, of the Armenians that were left in Nagorno-Karabakh have left and are doing so in part motivated by intimidation from the Azeri military, but I would say largely, certainly in the urban environments, simply by fear of what the new set of circumstances might bring.
One of the sadder things is, wasn't there an EU attempted negotiation where Armenia said they'd give up this region, and Azerbaijan was like, it's okay, we'll probably take that region and some other regions as well. We don't really need this agreement.
The fact is, Ruri, and as I said at the beginning, I'm someone who's a lot more sympathetic to Azerbaijan and Turkey.
Mm-hmm.
I think that what we have to keep front and center is the suffering of these tens of thousands of Armenians who had very little to do with the crimes committed by Armenian leadership. I do think it's worth pointing out just how extraordinarily irresponsible a solid three decades worth of Armenian leadership has been. And this week I'm going to be very rooted in sympathy and horror at what is happening to the Armenians on the ground. But I think going forward, and I think I will emphasize in this podcast, I remain filled with rage at the Armenian leaders that I believe did the most to bring about this result. To be clear, that's not including Nikol Pashinyan, the poor bastard who's in charge while this is happening. In fact, the Armenian politicians who are most responsible for this catastrophe are in fact operating in opposition to Pashinyan right now and are sort of eagerly waiting in the wings to use this catastrophe that they did the most to create over decades to get back into power. It's the history, to answer your question more directly, the history of negotiation over Nagorno-Karabakh is very, very, very long. And it's one of the things that I've been bothered by over the past weeks, the way that it's been either misrepresented or entirely ignored in the coverage of this horror that is unfolding. What I kind of want to do today, Ruri, is actually go all the way back. I feel like there's a lot of focusing, I think, incredibly justly, if you focus on what's going on since December of 2022 and 2023, it's very easy to make the Azeris out to be the villains. In fact, they are the villains from December of 2022 to 2023. I think a lot about power. on this podcast more generally. One of the reasons why I am very unsympathetic to the U.S. foreign policy establishment is because I believe that we have the most power and have had the most power for about a century now, and that that power has only grown exponentially over the past century. So in any given conflict, I look at it and say, the U.S. has more power, so we have more responsibility for what's going wrong here. That's a pretty baseline for what I have. Since 2020, and certainly for a decade or so before that, though not quite revealed, Azerbaijan was by far the more powerful entity here. That was not the case in the 1990s or the 2000s. And I think...
So we're going back to the fall of the Soviet Union?
Oh, no, Rory. We're going back 1,000 years.
Oh, my goodness.
And I think that's going to the root of this conflict, not in any way to attempt to exonerate Stalin, to exonerate the Azeri or Armenian leadership over the past 30 years. We'll get into that. Absolutely no charity or mercy for any of those folks. But I do think it is worth going all the way back because it seems like nobody does, because it seems like overly ambitious and complicated. But frankly, it's not that complicated why the Caucasus and Armenia and Azerbaijan are in such a strange, amorphous situation. And I think, frankly, both Azeri and Armenian advocates, perhaps it would be too strong to say that they're lying. Perhaps they're just operating out of ignorance. And this ignorance extends to a lot of the coverage in the West. So, you know, here at the More Freedom Foundation, we're a little more free to be a little more honest. So we're going to try and do that right now. And I think the Caucasus is interesting because it presents in a lot of ways as European. And the EU and NATO specifically have been really invested in this idea that Georgia, Armenia, Azerbaijan is just this little sort of island of Europe floating away, just a little bit, on the other side of Turkey and the other side of the Black Sea.
Well, places like Georgia would appear European-style cities if you were just, dropped in them and asked, where were you?
Well, and I don't want to, take away from sure, it's European culture, what have you, but the history of these places is dramatically different. And I think the way to understand Georgia, Armenia, Azerbaijan most fundamentally is that it's a battleground. It's a battleground between empires. For most of the past 500 years, it was primarily a battleground between the Iranians, the Safavid Empire with the Shia, and the Ottoman Sunni Turks. And please don't. I said Shia Sunni, and I'm afraid everyone's going to make it about Shia Sunni. Anger forever. But no. This is just one aspect of the rivalries. What makes the Caucasus Mountains absolutely fascinating is that this particular area below Russia, above Iran, to the east of Turkey, has been, frankly, part of the Muslim world for 1,000 years. You've got Yugoslavia, you've got a lot of Central or Eastern Europe, however you want to talk about it, that spent a lot of time as part of the Muslim world after the Ottoman conquest in the 1300s through the, it varies across the across Central Europe, how long that exposure was, how deep that was. But for most of Central Europe, Central and Eastern Europe, those countries began to come out of the Muslim world in the 1700s, and certainly by the 1800s, and before falling under communism and the unique weirdness that is the Soviet Union and the Soviet Union's sort of imperial influence, they had decades, if not a century or two, to develop along with Europe and to be part of the mainstream of European stuff. The Caucasus didn't really have that. If you really talk about the point where Georgia and Armenia and Azerbaijan, to a lesser extent, were able to start talking about being part of the European mainstream, you're talking about the 1990s, frankly. These areas were contested between the Turks and the Persians up until the 1800s. And then in the early 1800s, one thing that makes the Caucasus so distinctive is that they were in the Muslim world. They were largely conquered by the Muslim world, arguably going back as far as 1,000 years, but certainly going back centuries. And what made it different from, say, Iraq or much of the territory of what is now Russia that was taken in the 1600s through 1800s, is that it was able to hold on to a Christian identity because of the difficulty of the terrain, because of the Caucasus Mountains. It's fascinating when you think, like, Chechnya, Ingushetia, parts of Russia that are very, very Muslim, and that has been a huge issue for those regions and in Russian politics and what have you. Those are above the Caucasus, and then below the Caucasus you've got Persia, and then to the west of the Caucasus for however many hundreds of miles that Turkey and Anatolia is, that's all Muslim as well. So it was this island of weirdly preserved Christian territory. And the way that a lot of these Muslim empires worked is that they were like, oh man, this mountainous territory is a real pain in the ass. So what they would do is they would preserve actual Christian kings to act as vassals to sort of, and sometimes these territories would be ruled by satrapsies or emirates or this, that, and the other thing. But sometimes, and I think the Georgians have a much, much stronger historical claim to this, to really have sort of thousands of years of a Georgian polity. The Armenians don't really have that. And the Azeris, it's interesting because you've got the Armenians and the Azeris just sort of combating against each other, making these competing historical claims, when the sad truth is that they don't have that. Neither one of them really has the history of being in control of this territory for 1,000 years. There absolutely were grand Armenian kingdoms. The city of Ani is one of the most extraordinary sites. It's in eastern Turkey at this point, but it's a grand, old, ruined Armenian capital city, and I couldn't recommend it more to people. But the fact is that Armenians were a crucial part, and in some eras, a privileged part of the Ottoman hierarchy, of the Ottoman Empire. And there was not a large-scale, continuous Armenian polity in this area. And I think a lot of Armenian nationalists ignore that. The fact is, the sad or happy fact, happy then, sad now, is that this territory has been a patchwork of Christian and Muslim societies, of Turkic and Armenian societies, for 1,000 years. And what intervened was modern ideas of nationalism. And this idea that we need to be somehow separate, we need to have these contiguous territories that are just ours. And it's really shocking. I spent the morning just going through a documentary that I think was fairly balanced, just talking about really balanced towards the Armenians, frankly, talking about the 1990s war. And it was just fascinating talking about these names that have become very familiar to us over the past 3 years of covering Azerbaijan's conquest of Nagorno-Karabakh. You know, in the 1980s, Shusha, which was the territory that Azerbaijan took, I think the city or village that Azerbaijan took in 2020 that convinced the Armenians that the gig was up and they needed to find some kind of armistice, was in Nagorno-Karabakh, not in one of the surrounding territories that we'll talk about, was in Nagorno-Karabakh proper, and it was an Azeri city in the 1980s until it was entirely ethnically cleansed and became part of the Republic of Artsakh, which is just one of the reasons why I don't really like that terminology that we're all expected to just sort of reverence at this point. So that incredible complexity, that sort of surviving sort of Christian rump in the Caucasus has led to the very distinct character of that region. So frankly, both Azeri and Armenian claims to own this territory that's always been ours, that is ours forever, are both kind of not true. And there are elements of truth to that. There absolutely have been Turkic people living in villages in across the territory of Armenia and Azerbaijan for 1,000 years. There absolutely have been villages of Armenian people that have been established across Armenia and Azerbaijan for thousands of years. I think the Armenian claims that there's more millennia of continuity there might have some merit to them. But the truth is that for 1,000 years, they lived in that patchwork not necessarily always happily, certainly people oversell the tolerance of Muslim empires and sort of ignore the fact that we're talking about thousands of years of different versions of Muslim empires and emirates. Some of them were savage and horrific. Some of them were quite tolerant, even to modernize. Like it's just incredible variation that both the Azeris and the Armenians are trying to twist around very silly 19th century mythology around nationalism. And one thing that really gets my goat, and I think probably unwisely distances me from like the sympathy that I should have for Nagorno-Karabakh at this point. These tens of thousands of people, as many as 120,000 people, depending on whose numbers you believe, are the victims of history. And just like, it was the podcast I was listening to this morning where there's just some guy just like blithely ignoring everything that's happened that makes this conflict so tragic, and just pretending it's a story of cartoonish Azeri villainy is honestly a disservice to the people of the Armenians of Nagorno-Karabakh, because they are, I would argue, certainly victims of the Azeris, but also victims of Armenian leadership that hew to that exact narrative of exclusive Azeri villainy. So what happened was nationalism. I think it's a trope and entirely accurate to point out that Stalin and his nation's policy, what happened? So the Caucasus was part of the Islamic world until the 1800s. Russia takes over. That is a very different dynamic from what happens in the 1800s in Yugoslavia, in where you've got competing empires, you've got all the empires sort of competing. Sure, you've got, it's mostly between the Austro-Hungarian Empire and the Russian Empire, with differing versions of civilization and competing to build up areas, this, that, and the other thing. And then the British are coming in with their own ideas, especially down in Greece, and da-da-da-da-da-da. It's this incredible ferment that Eastern and Central Europe benefited from before the horrors of the 20th century. The Caucasus just got to be a little Russian backwater, and Russian ideas of Europeanness and civilization certainly filtered it down, but it was nowhere near to the same extent and development as what you got in Central Europe. And then the Soviets came, and the Soviets just decided all at once to funnel in these ideas of nationality and do things for their own purposes, but that also helped to spark a lot of interests on the ground. And I think we talked about power earlier, like this idea of like whoever is most powerful matters. I think it's fair to say that the Armenians were by far the most powerful of the two, the Armenians and the Azeris, from across the 20th century and really up until the oil and gas revenues really started rolling into Azerbaijan.
Why was that within the Soviet Union? Or was Armenia more powerful?
Well, unfortunately, the incredible horror that horrific experience that the Armenians had under the Ottoman Empire contributed to that. At first, the Armenians really benefited in the 19th century. They were Christian. They were better positioned to benefit from the interfacing with the European world that was essentially taking over the Ottoman Empire throughout the 19th century. Many of them became wealthy, became an important mercantile class within the Ottoman Empire. And that was even before European influence. They had already occupied, some Armenians had already occupied that sort of role. And then unfortunately, horrifically, the Ottomans, as they discovered their own visions of nationalism, not just the Young Turks, but before that, with the various iterations of the Ottoman sultans trying to figure out nationalism, I think they call it the Hamidian massacres in sort of the 1880s, 1890s. Were the first real, like, horrific turning against the Armenians by the Ottoman state. And then, of course, in 1915, we had the full Armenian genocide. But when we get to the 1920s and the Armenian refugees and Armenians who had always lived there in present-day Armenia, Azerbaijan, and Nagorno-Karabakh, they had had this experience of a century of becoming wealthy, becoming educated, becoming exposed to nationalist ideas, a better sense of like how to organize a polity and a nation and a society along modern westernized lines. The Azeris were just, I mean, they were put upon by the, you know, they were a subordinate class in the Persian Empire. There was a subordinate class in the Russian Empire. And really, there were a subordinate class throughout the time in the Soviet Union, because Armenians were westernized, literate, fluent with the socialist ideology that you needed to be fluent with to rise in the Soviet Union. Not saying that they were an especially privileged class in the Soviet Union, but they were better positioned to be able to take advantage of what was going on there. And the Azeris were not. You know, I think the Armenians have a deeper history of literacy, a deeper history of just by virtue of having the much larger exposure to the Mediterranean and European currents than the Azeris did. And in the 1990s, the Armenians used that position of greater power to truly abuse Azerbaijan in very deep ways that were actually recognized by the world at large at that point. It's been interesting, sort of, you know, when people, Armenian advocates, like to discuss, you know, what's been going on, they just sort of like try to gloss over the fact that like the whole world recognizes that what Armenia did in the 1990s was atrocious. We are now dealing with an ethnic cleansing of 120,000 people, and that is horrific. In the 1990s, the Armenians carried out an ethnic cleansing of 650,000 people. That's the figure that the New York Times uses. 650,000 Azeris were booted out of not just Nagorno-Karabakh, but also the territories that Armenia took beyond Nagorno-Karabakh. It was never okay under international law. And a lot of the people were like, no, this is the Republic of Artsakh. This is Artsakh, We're talking about territory that they had taken when I was in high school and ethnically cleansed to the tune of over 500,000 people when I was in high school. So I have this is why I do not enjoy the sort of Republic of Artsakh language that is being bandied about in understandable solidarity, you know, and people can make their own choices for that sort of thing. But I'm not a huge...
Would this be why you tend to see things more through the Azerbaijani point of view?
I think it's because I'm always thinking in the lens through the lens of power and who was more powerful. And since the certainly we it all became very clear to everybody. I think it was clear to many people by the first or certainly by the beginning of the second decade of this century that the Armenians were in serious trouble. The problem was that it was not clear to the Armenian leadership. And that the Armenian leadership, just as Azerbaijan's leadership, which is a dictatorship, is so wrapped up in this idea that, you know, we have to fight Armenians, that even after they've defeated them, you know, that continues to be the motivator. The Armenian leadership, even after it was pretty apparent that they were, you know, operating an empire built on sand. They, you know, just, oh, well, we're just going to believe in it harder and we're just going to talk more about Artsakh and actually get more aggressive in our claims about what we're going to do with all this territory that the entire world recognizes as belonging to Azerbaijan. And it did not go well, Murray. It does not go well.
Is this basically as soon as Russia was unable to defend Armenia, sort of realities kicked in?
This morning I tried to parse what was going. The reality kicking in is certainly, you know, I think it's an open question whether we would have seen this final crushing of Nagorno-Karabakh if it weren't for Russia's invasion of Ukraine. But there was a very serious war in 2020 when Putin was still being bandied about as, you know, a serious rival to the United States or what have you. And in fact, I made a video talking about how Putin was the biggest winner of the Nagorno-Karabakh war in 2020. I think it became apparent by the aughts and certainly the beginning of the teens that the momentary advantage, that advantage we were just talking about, that just so that sort of centuries or decades head start with ideas of nationalism and state formation that Armenia very much still had in the 1990s had sort of evaporated under the pressure of incredible Azeri oil wealth, oil and gas wealth, maybe even gas wealth primarily. So it was already clear that Azerbaijan, which I believe has a population that's double or three times the size of Armenia's.
Yes, it is now. So I think Armenia's has declined since the fall of the Soviet Union. So it's roughly 2.5 million, while Azerbaijan's getting close to 10 million.
Oh, so four times the size. Yes. The size, and also making money hand over fist throughout the China boom of the first decade of the century. It was good times for Azerbaijan. And I don't know what, I think I know what the Armenian leadership was thinking. They're like, well, we've got Russia, we've got the West, we've got Armenian diasporas in California and Paris that are going to defend us. We can, if we're just tough enough, you know, talk enough stuff, we'll be able to hold the line. And what happened in 2020 is it became very clear that they could not hold the line. I think it's important to make a distinction here. So there is Nagorno-Karabakh, which is a, I've made videos on this recently as last week, where you can see some maps here, which is like a chunk of territory outlined by the Soviets, intentionally cutting out as many Azeri villages as possible. It's this very weird little chunk of territory that is sort of an island within Azerbaijan. There's no direct, and that's part of the problem over the past year, there's no direct connection.
It's like a wee enclave, isn't it?
Yes, it is a wee enclave. It is a floating within Azerbaijan.
It does look very unnatural.
Yeah. And even with the work that the Soviets did to carve out as many Azeri villages in that, there were serious Azeri villages within that in the 1980s, as we talked about Shusha earlier. So it's this weird thing. So in the 1990s, the Armenians had, at the government level, the Armenians definitely, I think it's fair to say, but keep in mind I'm biased and this is not deep research, but at the governing level, I think it was the Armenians who saw the collapse of the Soviet Union, or even before the collapse, with Gorbachev's glasnost and perestroika, saw this as the time to like, okay, now we're gonna get ours. We're gonna make sure that this enclave gets added to Armenia instead of Azerbaijan, and any other territory, even if it's majority Azeri, we're gonna work to get that added to Armenia as well. And they were at a political level working on this. I think you can make an argument that because the Azeris just simply didn't have the wherewithal to the extent that the Azeris had like a modern political national idea of itself, it was one that was largely foisted upon them by the Soviets. And if your national idea and your national political will and sense of yourself is like exclusively given to you by like Stalin and the Soviets, like it's not going to be as strong. It's not going to be as powerful. And you talk about this war in the 1990s where the Armenians were actually fairly well armed, fairly well provided for by the diaspora, by better connections with the Soviets, by having just simply put in a decade of work before a full war broke out. And the Azeris were completely unprepared, despite even having a large, maybe back then their population was only double the size of Armenians. Just, they were just completely unprepared at the outbreak of war. And the Armenians steamrolled them, absolutely steamrolled them, took Nagorno-Karabakh, this enclave, had its own military force, which was actually just committed to be disbanded over the past 72 hours. Its own defense force, its own military force. It was able to fight against the Azeri military. The Armenia proper military fought against the Azeri military, and there just wasn't much of an Azeri military to fight against. So over the course of a really just nasty war, it ended in 1994. I don't know if you call the formal start of the war in 1991 or 1992, but there were tit-for-tat reprisals and savagery and nastiness. And I would not exonerate the Azeris on any. They were certainly the weaker actors, but that doesn't mean that they didn't do horrifically brutal things. I think Sumgait was an early massacre. It is interesting, though, because if you spend any time in YouTube comments with dueling Azeri and Armenian nationalists, the Azeris will go, oh, Kocaeli, you know, Kocaeli, you murdered all our people in Kocaeli. And then the Armenians will be like, well, you murdered all our people in Sumgait first. And then you look at the details and Sumgait was like 50 people were killed. Terrific. And Kocaeli, 1,000 Azeris were slaughtered. men, women, and children. Like throughout the story of the 1990s conflict, there's this imbalance. The Azeris certainly committed horrible atrocities and brutalities, but they were just not prepared for this conflict that Armenian politicians largely chose. And one of the truly pathological elements of this, one of the great problems, is that Armenian independence, the whole movement, the whole independence set of politicians and rhetoric that was around the initial setting up of the Armenian independent Armenian state, was deeply rooted in wanting to beat up the Azeris over Karabakh. I was interested to learn just this morning that I think the initial independence leaders of Armenia had their genesis in something called the Karabakh Committee, which was basically a bunch of folks in Yerevan in Armenia proper, like trying to figure out how to annex Nagorno-Karabakh. So, and the leadership class up until Pashinyan was almost exclusively members of this Karabakh Committee. Part of the great dishonesty and failure of Armenians in negotiation over this issue in the 30 years between 1994, well, I guess 26 years between 1994 and 2020, was that they'd be like, oh, well, you know, Nagorno-Karabakh's its own thing, and, you know, they're kind of doing their own thing. And yet multiple presidents of the Armenian Republic would become presidents of the Armenian Republic after having leadership positions in Nagorno-Karabakh. So it's just this, anyway, 1994, Armenians steamroll Azerbaijan, and this is crucial and is left out of every Armenian nationalist discussion, because if they do discuss it, then their whole story falls apart. Nagorno-Karabakh, that enclave we were talking about, in 1994, there were five other Azeri jurisdictions that surround Nagorno-Karabakh that allow that big chunk of Azerbaijan that was being called the Republic of Artsakh to exist. That is where 650,000 Azeris lived that were all driven out in sort of one of the greatest ethnic cleansings of the 1990s you've never heard of. That was pretty dark. Whenever I hear some Armenian nationalist talking about the virtues and the poor put upon nature of the Republic of Artsakh, it's impossible for me to not think of those 650,000 people. I read a great Twitter thread past couple days. I retweeted it. This Azeri, who was a not Nagorno-Karabakh, I can't. He was in one of the. His family grew up in one of those jurisdictions that Armenia had taken, and he had to leave as a refugee in his youth. And it was a very poignant Twitter thread talking about his experience and how desperately sad he was to see that experience imposed on another 100,000 human beings that just happened to be Armenians. And it is incredibly tragic. But this is not just a continuation of the Armenian genocide. This is not exclusively about Azeri villainy. Since December of 2022, yeah, it's a story exclusively about Azeri villainy. They did not need to do this. They did not need to push this far. But because, and then this is something that was just left out of that podcast I listened to this morning, is that the victory against Armenia and Nagorno-Karabakh was completely achieved in 2020. They took those five regions back. And honestly, the fact that Nagorno-Karabakh was allowed to continue to exist surrounded by Russian peacekeepers, it was like a fig leaf to the international community that actually really helped Azerbaijan, because they got to win everything they'd always wanted and not have to have the stain of ethnic cleansing over their heads. I don't think it's it's surprising how quickly Nagorno-Karabakh gave up. Last week, it was 24 hours. 3 weeks ago, I was reading about, oh gosh, the third Nagorno-Karabakh war is about to start. We're going to see this horrific thing, and it literally lasted 24 hours. Like, the main fighting was over in 2020.
Well, they had been under siege for about 6 months, haven't
yes,
they?
Yes, since December of 2022, the Azeri, the Lachin Corridor, which also I learned was, you know, mostly inhabited by Azeris and was taken during the 1994 war, became incredibly vital after 2020, because that was the corridor connecting the enclave of what was left of the enclave of Nagorno-Karabakh. In 2020, the Armenian state and the Armenians in Nagorno-Karabakh capitulated because I think Azerbaijan took Shusha and had taken, I don't know, 30% to 50% of even Nagorno-Karabakh proper. So, but the only connection between Nagorno-Karabakh and the Armenian state was the Lachin corridor. And in December of 2022, Azerbaijan started blocking that. It's interesting to think, like, honestly, if that status, what's worse? Would it have been that status quo continuing and tens of thousands of nominally somewhat kind of autonomous Armenians starving to death in Nagorno-Karabakh? Is that worse, or is this very brutal ending worse in that they're not starving, they're just moving to Armenia? That's an honest open question. I don't know. I know they're both horrible.
Yeah, I don't think anyone can really answer that.
But it's...
What does this mean for Nakhchivan Autonomous Republic?
Damned if I know. An oddity that really testifies to just how interweaved the Armenian and Azeri populations were is that there's another enclave involved here.
Yes.
Was fairly quickly established
between Armenia and Iran this time.
Yeah, Azerbaijan has a chunk of Azerbaijan that is on the other side of Armenia, which just sort of indicates how, and also beyond the 650,000 folks that were kicked out of the parts of Azerbaijan that Armenia conquered in the 90s, there were also hundreds of thousands of Azeris that were cleansed out of our today's Armenia, and hundreds of thousands of Armenians that were cleansed out of today's Azerbaijan. It was an even distribution, and had been for 1,000 years. And it is just an incredible testament to just the horrors of nationalism.
So you're putting a lot of hope or responsibility on Turkey because you feel they're the only ones that can help. Are they doing anything, or are they just sort of using all their drone knowledge from a different war in this one?
I think the knowledge that's being applied in Ukraine was in fact built during that 2020 war. I think absolutely the Bayraktar drones that have been so useful to the Ukrainian forces, a lot of the back-end software was developed and tested in the first major way, helping Azerbaijan crush the Armenians in that, I think, 40 to 44 day war back in 2020. At this point, the Turks aren't, I mean, there wasn't much fighting here. There was just a 24-hour thing, and now the Nagorno-Karabakh Autonomous Region that apparently, I think, was established in 1922 or 1923 is now over. The actual work of the fighting that Turkey and also Israel very much helped with, it was a lot of Israeli drone technology as well, that was back in 2020. I do think it's very likely that Turkey already is having a moderating influence. I think they absolutely could do more. I think there probably are people in the Turkish foreign ministry who are like, hey, dumbasses, like, keep your troops in line. I think it's an open question. How systematic, there's no question that horrific atrocities have been committed against Armenian military forces and Armenian civilians over the past 4 years. There's a lot of questions there. How much is that just sort of forgiven and papered over by the Azeri leadership? How much of that is conscious by the Azeri leadership? I can't answer any of those questions. I do think that Turkey is probably pretty vocally, through back channels, like, do less of that. Win, but like, don't make it easy to portray us as your backers and yourselves as animals, as rabid animals. So that's an interesting, but I would think that Turkey, honestly, this could have been worse and could very well get worse and could very well be much worse through just information we simply don't have from what's happening in Armenian villages in Nagorno-Karabakh. But I do think that the Turks are probably exerting some influence to try to keep it from getting worse. Azerbaijan's leadership can't admit that they've won because so much of their legitimacy is about fighting Armenians. So, they've got to be embarrassed by how easy it was to, I mean, they've been talking for 3 years about this terrible thorn in their side, this incredible threat of the independent Nagorno-Karabakh military and who would allow militias on their territory, blah, blah, blah. And the fact that they wiped them all up in 24 hours the Azeri leadership can't deal with the fact that they've mission accomplished. They've gotten what they needed to get done, what they've been talking about for three decades done. I kind of feel like the Turks are like, hey, we did it. It's cool. You know, like the Turks,
we can stop.
Like, Turks are like, hey, okay, cool. Like, cool. Turkish brothership. Yay. We've done it. Yay. Like, and really don't want this to jeopardize their always tempestuous relationships with Europe and the United States. So I think it's a very long way of answering your question. I think that behind the scenes, the Turks are probably doing something to try to keep this a little more moderate and keep this a little less damaging, but obviously it's not enough.
Because it seems like the obvious thing, because, you know, bringing back to that EU attempted peace treaty or negotiation, is that they're going to essentially meet up again with Nakhchivan. So the idea is there's like a little gap at the very bottom of Armenia. So they're going to sort of essentially push through there, can sort of reunify the country proper, because they're basically saying we don't have to negotiate, we have the means to do this the hard way, the military way, and we will.
I don't think they have the means to do that. I think that no.
You don't?
I think that if they I thought they'd be too smart to actually do what they just did in Nagorno-Karabakh, so don't ask me.
They were going to get that peacefully.
No,
apparently.
They were never going to get that peacefully. No.
You think Armenia was just saying that at the meetings?
Yeah. Okay. No, that's the idea that Nikol Pashinyan is someone I have some grudging respect for. And the fact that he's still in power, I think he even won an election after 2020, which is extraordinary. And he did come to power as probably the most democratic leader that Armenia had ever had. For it came to power in sort of a velvet revolution in 2018 and has won an election since, even after being the guy, you know, in charge nominally when Nagorno-Karabakh was lost. He's been playing a really dangerous game that he had no choice but to play between trying to curry favor with Russia and the West. And honestly, Nagorno-Karabakh finally falling is kind of liberating for him in that he's always been sort of an anti-Russia actor, and he can now say, well, Russia betrayed us, and he can sort of double down on currying favor with the West. Defending...
Because the CSTO seems like it's just a... doesn't exist at
exactly.
this point.
The sort of wannabe NATO that Russia had set up, that was sort of under those auspices that Russia came in as the peacekeepers, as the big winners of the 2020 war. And yeah, that looks like a pretty dead letter now. The Zeng Zagir corridor to Nakhchivan, apologize for my pronunciation, is a different animal. That is fully, at no point was even the autonomous region of Nagorno-Karabakh internationally recognized as anything other than Azeri territory.
Yeah, because most countries didn't recognize it as Armenian, isn't that
I don't
right?
think anybody did. Certainly not the main...
And because technically it was like its own little state, it wasn't Armenia proper.
It was an autonomous region that decided to set up its own government in the aftermath of the fall of the Soviet Union. The Stalin or what have you had sort of given it a special status because he found it more easier way to create exactly the kind of chaos we've seen. And Nagorno-Karabakh declared itself to be an independent country, and nobody really, I don't think anybody... And I can't think of anybody who might have recognized that. I don't know, maybe some small... No, the Armenians don't have the kind of money to buy small Pacific nations that would have recognized that. So if the Azeri military were seriously to attempt to conquer another country. That's the key thing here is that everything we've discussed, the 2020 war, the what happened over these past weeks is technically under international law, under the rules-based order or what have you, is an example of self-defense on the part of Azerbaijan to correct an unlawful invasion and occupation that happened in the 1990s. If they were to attempt to blast a hole through Armenia, that would be an illegal, unjust invasion of a sovereign country. And I think that the way that the international community would act. Now, Azerbaijan may think that because the Israelis love him and because the Europeans need his gas, that he can get away with that. Maybe I'm naive in thinking there's enough left in the way that the world is organized to keep that from being as easy. But my concern with like the years of negotiations is there's so many missed opportunities. There was a point at which Azerbaijan was seriously considering allowing Nagorno-Karabakh and a small land corridor to be Armenia in return for a small land corridor between Nakhchivan and Azerbaijan. That was something that was on the table in the 1990s and that the Armenians balked at over and over and over again. There were 30 years of negotiations where the Armenians would be like, no, we've got what we've got, we're keeping it. And the Azeris would just get more and more powerful and say, hey, man, like, this is legally ours. You don't take this seriously. Eventually, we're going to come back and take it. And Pashinyan, in part because he was more democratic than most of the other Armenian leaders, kind of had to, in some ways, double down on this myth that Artsakh existed, or that like we were actually, you know, they were actually going to be able to make a greater Armenia. And when, you know, with that rhetoric, that doubling down, Azerbaijan said, okay, well, we tried diplomacy for 30 years and we're just going to steamroll. And they did. And it's incredibly dark. And incredibly...
What would you like to see from the international community on this matter?
Well, I put out a video last week saying like, we got to restrain them. We got to see what we can do to try and keep Armenians in Nagorno-Karabakh. And that's over. You know, like I think there was numbers like 60,000 new Armenian refugees have showed up. Nominally, according to the Armenians in Nagorno-Karabakh, there were 120,000 people left in Nagorno-Karabakh. But I think most, not just Azeri, but most international sources thought it was in like the 90s. So we're talking about 2/3 of the people left in Nagorno-Karabakh have already left. It really seems to me really like this is a tragedy that has happened. And it's very dark. I was talking with a friend this morning and I was saying like, yeah, I mean, I guess it is what it is. And, you know, actually it makes things a little easier for Armenia. They can finally move forward from this crazy issue. And he was like, yeah, I mean, but that's kind of 1920s thinking, Rob. Like, that's kind of like this idea that, oh, we're just going to do a population transfer and everything will be hunky-dory. And that is not, you know, exactly how it worked out for Turkey and Greece. I mean, on some levels it did. You know, they those issues became resolved, and certainly the rivalry was preserved. I don't think Armenia and Azerbaijan are going to have friendly relations.
Be friends anytime soon.
Friendly relations in anybody, the lifetime of anybody now living. But Armenia can potentially move forward. Azerbaijan, you know, I don't think that Aliyev has the capacity to actually invade Armenia. What we have seen over the past 3 years that is very confusing is we have seen incursions from Azerbaijan into Armenia because nobody knows what the border is. Keep in mind that since the 1990s and the fall of the Soviet Union, these countries were all one country, you know, from Baku to Moscow, from Baku to St. Petersburg. That was all one country. In the 90s, Azerbaijan and Armenia fought a war where half of the border between Armenia and Azerbaijan was in illegally annexed territory that the Armenians were holding. So I think it's there have been disputes where dozens of people have died over the past 3 years over that Armenian-Azeri border. But I think that's more of a function of sorting out where that border actually is than it is an invasion. I think if there were an invasion, if Ilham Aliyev, the hereditary dictator of Azerbaijan, really was brazen enough to attempt to invade Armenia, I would be for U.S. intervention, you know, which is not something I'm very often for. But that would be an actual, that would be George W. Bush shit. That would be like actually invading another country. That would be Vladimir, the kind of stuff that Vladimir Putin fails to do. That would be, and you know what? Azerbaijan doesn't have nukes. We could obliterate an Azeri attempt to take Armenia from the Black Sea, from Malta, from frickin' Arizona. And we should do so.
But would it just America being nearby and showing its intent, like not even physically doing anything, not be enough to stop anything from actually happening?
But no, I actually do believe, Ray, and this is very uncharacteristic to me, that if, you know, Azeri tanks rolled into, you know, rolled across the border in force, you know, in a stab towards Yerevan, I think that the United States should blow up those tanks. It wouldn't be a bad idea if Biden were to say we'll do that. We don't need to have, we've already got all the resources we need fairly close by to do that. Another in a long line of issues where we'd be on the exact same side as Iran, which would be kind of
maybe you're secretly best friends. It'll just take a long time to find out.
It's interesting. Like, I was thinking about just sort of historical parallels here, and also I do think it's worth mentioning, I think I have a reason to care about this and a reason to be as bothered by this as I am. And I think that any person who's dedicated their lives to these issues, a lot of the folks that I've been reading over the recent days, you know, have a right to be very concerned about this. But it does stick in my craw a little bit that we're so concerned across the broader foreign policy space about Nagorno-Karabakh when you just consider what's been going on in Ethiopia over the past 3 years. Interestingly, you know, Abiy Ahmed's war against Tigray, or debatably Tigray's war against Abiy Ahmed, I don't want to make all the Ethiopians angry, launched at the same point as the Azeri war against Nagorno-Karabakh. They were both timed, I believe, to coincide with the U.S. not paying attention because it was in the final weeks of the 2020 election. The actual fighting and large-scale death was over in 44 days around Nagorno-Karabakh back in 2020. The Ethiopian war lasted for 2 years, and now there's another one. And all of the horrors, the worst imaginings of the most fervent Armenian diaspora nationalists are happening in Ethiopia every day. And it is a little messed up that, you know, we are so concerned about, you know, a few hundred thousand white Christians, really a little over 100,000 white Christians. However, as a counterpoint to that, like, this is history happening. For my entire life, paying attention to European and Asian geopolitics, the post-Soviet frozen conflicts have been a tremendous dynamic. Now there are three. There used to be four. Now there are three. Transnistria in Moldova, Abkhazia and South Ossetia in Georgia, and Nagorno-Karabakh. It's been resolved. It's horrifically so. Not as horrifically as it could have been. And that's an incredible historical shift that is happening and should be marked. It is not the kind of thing we'd like to see happening in our post-World War II, supposedly hunky-dory world, least of all in a place that some consider to be Europe. History does happen, and we're seeing it unfold right now.
Have you any final thoughts, Rob?
Well, it's a bit inappropriate, but I'm constantly making historical analogies. And one of the reasons why this is so significant is the specter of the Armenian genocide. In 1915, the Ottoman government, falling apart as it was, carried out a policy of extermination against its Armenian population. And a lot of the refugees from that were the folks who founded modern Armenia and Nagorno-Karabakh, what have you. And it's interesting because certainly that historical episode is rightly front of people's minds as we deal with this horror. But I actually think of a different nationalities question in the Ottoman Empire. I think that I would never say that the people of Nagorno-Karabakh in any way deserve what is happening to them. But I do think that they have been put into this position, not like the Armenians in 1915, almost exclusively because of the evils of an aggressor. Not that there aren't evils of the aggressor here, but because of incredibly poor decisions by their own leadership. And that actually makes me think of the Greek populations of the Ottoman Empire. Some folks in recent years have attempted to talk about the Greek genocide and Mustafa Kemal Atatürk, the founder of modern Turkey, did to the Greeks into the same bucket as what the Ottomans did to the Armenians. And there's been a lot of pushback to that because they're very different situations. What happened to the Greeks of Anatolia, who lived there for thousands of years, is that there was a Greek government who decided to take advantage of the Ottoman Empire's loss of World War I to invade the territory that was just becoming modern Turkey. Decided to push their luck and decided to rampage through and committed all kinds of horrific atrocities against the Turkish populace. And then the Turks pushed back and truly with their own passels of truly horrific actions. And it's interesting thinking about that and thinking about how no matter how badly the Armenian leadership of today wants to cloak themselves in the virtue of the horrors of the 1915 genocide, it's actually something like the Greeks of the 1920s that the leadership bears incredible responsibility for. That makes it fundamentally very different. But let us never forget that whether you were a Greek in Anatolia in the 1920s who was forced to move to a Greece you'd never heard of. Or whether you're a Nagorno-Karabakh citizen in 2023, being forced to leave behind everything that you know, we should always blame the leaders and not the people that suffer from bad leadership.